14 states and a U.S. territory, more than 1,300 delegates, and maybe a Democratic field whittled to just one. That's what's up for grabs on Super Tuesday. I'm Saul Gonzalez, co-host of the California Report from KQED in San Francisco.
And I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think from KERA in Dallas. We're teaming up for the countdown to Super Tuesday. And over the next hour, we'll hear how votes translate to delegates.
We have Super Tuesday, or what I like to call Tsunami Tuesday, because there's so many delegates at stake.
We'll talk about the possibility of not knowing the Democratic Party nominee ahead of the convention.
Political scientists and political junkies have lived all of our lives for this scenario.
And voters share how they're picking their presidential candidate.
Worrying about electability like it's a popularity contest is something that got us into this whole mess in the first place.
The countdown to Super Tuesday begins after a short break.
For months on end, a single state captured our attention.
Most of all, I want to thank the Iowans that are here.
Thank you, Iowa. Thank you so much.
Iowa, you have shocked the nation.
Next, everyone grabbed a coat and headed east.
It's new for me to be running for president, but it's not new for me to be coming to New Hampshire.
Let me take this opportunity to thank the people of New Hampshire for a great victory tonight.
And then it was a mad dash west.
And the people of New Hampshire, because of you, we are taking this campaign to Nevada. Yeah!
Those early primary contests vaulted Bernie Sanders to an early lead as he claimed about 40% of the 100 or so delegates available. Another 54 are up for grabs Saturday in South Carolina. But on Tuesday, more than 1,300 delegates are in play. I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think from KERA in Dallas.
And I'm Saul Gonzalez, co-host of the California Report from KQED in San Francisco. Over the next hour, we're going to preview what's at stake on Super Tuesday. That's when 14 states cast their votes. They're Alabama, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, and Virginia. Big breath.
I counted, and that was indeed 14. And we should add to the list American Samoa and Democrats living abroad who will also vote Tuesday.
But let's start with the latest from the campaign trail. NPR senior political editor Domenico Montanaro joins us from Washington, D.C. Thanks for coming on.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
So what is your analysis of the state of play in this election right now heading into Super Tuesday?
Well, you know, we've got Bernie Sanders, who's clearly a front runner in this race. I mean, he won the popular vote in Iowa. He won New Hampshire. And what was most eye-opening is how he won Nevada. He won it overwhelmingly, was able to expand his coalition. And the most important figure was the fact that he won Latinos overwhelmingly. And the reason I say that is because if you look at Super Tuesday, California and Texas, Colorado potentially, have really big populations of Democratic Latinos who could really make a big difference with huge caches of delegates in those states that could give Sanders a kind of lead that he's not catchable with in a pledged delegate race if the other quote-unquote moderates in the race can't figure out who they want to coalesce around.
Candidates who had maybe a disappointing start, of course, have been determined to at least make it to Super Tuesday.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay in this for the long haul. I think we'll do well here. I think we'll win here. And I think this could end up being a race between me and Bernie before it's over.
That was former Vice President Joe Biden. What is the threshold for candidates currently trailing Bernie Sanders to stay in the race?
Well, you know, all of the candidates have to get at least 15% to get any delegates whatsoever in every single contest. It's not just in caucuses overall. So, you know, these candidates are going to have to figure out what their rationale is going forward. And when you have 35%, more than a third of the delegates up for grabs on Super Tuesday, you know, if you come out fifth place, fourth place after Super Tuesday, what is your viable path forward at that point? I think that has to be a real conversation within the campaigns. We've seen a lot of campaigns that are able to kind of continue past where you might have seen in prior years because of how they raise money. You're seeing more and more campaigns able to, you know, raise money with smaller donors over a longer period of time using online donations and have been able to enable them to stay in the race longer.
And as the other candidates try to keep up with Sanders and challenge him, and with Super Tuesday approaching, where do they go? What states do you think are most in play if you're trailing Sanders, which is everyone?
Yeah, well, you know, you can't ignore California and Texas. I mean, I'm sorry, they are 600 plus delegates in the race. And, you know, if Sanders is able to build the kind of lead that's possible, if someone just allows him to, you know, take hold in those places, you can't catch somebody when they've got that many, that big of a lead in that kind of a state, with those delegates being as large as they are. Now, if you're someone like Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota or Pete Buttigieg, you know, they're going to look at the fact that they can do well, with Buttigieg in particular, college-educated white voters. So you look at states like Colorado, Maine, other places like that, either on March 3rd and on March 10th. I mean, Elizabeth Warren, too, competing with Buttigieg for those college-educated white voters. But they're not enough to win the Democratic nomination. You've got to be able to win over voters of color. And that is in California, Texas, North Carolina, which a lot of people not talking about. But almost 100 delegates at stake on Super Tuesday in North Carolina as well.
There is one high-profile Republican who seems to be a very vocal Bernie Sanders supporter, and that is President Trump.
And the Washington Democrats have never been more extreme. 132 congressional Democrats have signed up for Bernie Sanders' government health care takeover bill. It's a takeover of your health care that would strip all of those 180 million great Americans of your private coverage. You want that. You got great deals. You're able to negotiate. You're able to keep your doctor, keep your area, keep your hospitals, keep everything that you wanted. Now they want to take it away. Report to an operating room when you have a cold, okay? In your local hospital. I don't think so. 180 million people. But I'm not going to knock it, because I want Bernie to bring it right up to the end, and we'll debate it the day before the election, okay?
Is it reasonable for him to think Senator Sanders would be the easiest of the Democratic field to beat?
You know, if we're thinking about traditional political thinking, there's an obvious argument to that. I mean, Bernie Sanders identifies as a Democratic socialist, and that rankles some of Sanders' supporters when we lump in Democratic socialism with socialism itself. But most Americans don't know the difference. They don't recognize the difference. What Sanders is going to have to explain and make the case on his economic policies is to say that he wants something that's more akin to Norway and Denmark than Venezuela and Nicaragua.
Our proposal, which costs $2.2 trillion over 10 years, will be fully paid for by a tax on Wall Street speculation, similar to what exists in dozens of countries around the world.
Whether most Americans can even find those places on a map is, one thing. Making them know the difference between what their economic philosophies are is something completely else. So the Trump campaign feels like they would be able to batter Sanders with a lot of that stuff, a lot of the alleged sympathies he's had for socialist regimes in the past, and be able to go after him on that. Sanders, on the other hand, feels like, hey, healthcare should be a right for everybody, and that shouldn't be controversial, and that college tuition is too high. Why not have public colleges be free and reduce or eliminate student loan debt for a lot of people? It's a huge problem. These are huge problems. The government hasn't been able to solve them with the current thinking. That is going to be the argument if Bernie Sanders is the nominee. His campaign say that they can drive up turnout with young voters in particular and with people in the cities. Will that be enough? You know, for the House, we're hearing from a lot of down-ballot Democrats who've won in center-right districts who don't want to run with Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. But this is a totally new era in American politics, and I don't think anybody knows exactly how it would play out.
Do you think you can overstate the queasiness of a lot of voters who don't like President Trump and want to see him leave office, that they still just don't know who the candidate is who would be able to do that?
Yeah, that was an idea that Tom Steyer hit on during the debate in South Carolina Tuesday night.
This conversation shows a huge risk for the Democratic Party. We are looking at a party that has decided that we're either going to support someone who's a Democratic socialist or somebody who has a long history of being a Republican. And I am scared. If we cannot pull this party together, if we go to one of those extremes, we take a terrible risk of reelecting Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think the most important thing in any reelection is the president and his standing. You know, he has, you know, had a very consistent approval rating, but his approval rating has been consistently historically low. You know, he's been in the low to mid 40s as his high as far as job approval rating goes. And the most important things for a president when it comes to their reelection is the economy good, and is the United States entangled in a foreign policy development that's going badly or well? And that, you know, right now with unemployment under 4% and no, you know, number of troops that you're seeing, names of them dying day after day on the evening news, like in 2006 or 2007 during the Iraq War, you're not having that right now. So that would make President Trump the favorite. If something changes, that would, you know, it would be difficult for him to win re-election, no matter who the Democrat is.
So to win the nomination, a Democratic candidate needs to secure not just a plurality of the delegates, but an actual majority. And yep. The political forecasting site 538 now is saying there's like a 40% chance that no Democrat will accumulate a majority of delegates by the end of the primaries. Are you starting to hear real concern among the campaigns that we might see a brokered convention?
Well, when you have a splintered field like this, it doesn't take, you know, complex mathematical models to realize that it's not going to be that easy to get 50% plus one. The magic number is 1,991 delegates. So far, we've had only 2.5% of those delegates allocated. Super Tuesday is going to give us a much bigger tranche of delegates. You know, we haven't had a brokered convention in a very long time. I think Democratic officials would very much like to avoid that. And Bernie Sanders is saying that you've got to give it to the person who's got the pledged delegate majority or pledged delegate lead, for that person to be the nominee. Of course, he says that because he looks like the person who might get that pledged delegate lead right now. And I think it would be very, very difficult for the party if Bernie Sanders or anyone else has, let's say, more than a 5% lead in the pledged delegate race and not give it to that person, especially if it's Bernie Sanders and the kind of strong support that he has from his base, who would, you know, most likely not really want to vote for somebody other than him, especially if they feel like it was taken away.
Domenico, what are Republicans and the Trump campaign doing to prepare for November while the Democrats are busy fighting over Super Tuesday?
Well, number one, they're raising a ton of money. And they are importantly investing in a lot of these key swing states, places that they think that they can expand, and especially on digital. You see them all over the place with Trump ads, trying to make the case for what the president has done in the first 3 years. If not to expand, then to definitely rev up his base and make sure everybody is out there. They feel like that there's a world in which they got more rural voters and people who agree with President Trump out to vote. They think that they didn't tap all of that potential, and they're really trying to target getting more people who agree with them out to the polls. I've talked to Democrats who also think that there is a significant number of potentially left-leaning people who did not vote in 2016, who they think they can get. So this is a really unique period in American politics where we're going to see both sides try to turn out more people who agree with them rather than try to persuade people in the middle. Although, there, of course, there will be a degree of persuasion going on. And, you know, it's sort of a false choice to say that, you know, it's a base election versus persuasion. They've got to do all of it, but Trump so far hasn't done a whole heck of a lot of trying to reach out to the middle.
If Saul and I were talking to you next Wednesday, which is to say the morning after Super Tuesday, do you think we'd be talking about a clearer picture for the Democratic presidential field or a cloudier one?
I think definitely a clearer picture, because we're going to have a whole lot more data, a whole lot more information, a whole lot more vote result. Now, the one caution I would say is maybe we need to talk Thursday rather than Wednesday, because on Wednesday, realize that California is very slow at counting their votes. So is Texas. And those are the big, big trenches of delegates. We may not have the dust completely settled, you know, 5 or 7 a.m. Wednesday morning. We may know a little bit more by Wednesday midday or afternoon or evening or Thursday morning.
Domenico Montanaro, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Coming up, how the geography of Super Tuesday affects how candidates reach voters.
Millions of people live in these states, and you have to have both an effective ground operation and a strong media presence. And a lot of candidates just aren't able to do that.
And we'll check on a 17-year-old first-time voter trying to make up her mind.
I'll just see which candidate would suit me better rather than the party.
That's when the countdown to Super Tuesday continues.
Hi, my name is Diego Estrada. I'm from Morse High School, and I've helped register over 650 Morse students in the past 2 years to either pre-register or register to vote. So Morse is a majority-minority school. We have a plurality Latino and Filipino population, and it's the most diverse school in San Diego. I'm president of this club called Inspire, and we just focus on civic engagement in high schools. In general, we did class-wide presentations. We showed them the importance of voting through local elections and how just a couple votes changed and flipped seats. Southeast San Diego in general has been stigmatized to kind of be against and non-political. And through these events, and hopefully Inspire has been showing that the rest of the school district, that Morse is not something to be slept on.
That was Diego Estrada, a 17-year-old student at Morse High School in San Diego. I'm Saul Gonzalez, co-host of the California Report from KQED in San Francisco.
And I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think from KERA in Dallas. This is the Countdown to Super Tuesday, a co-production of Public Radio's Texas and California newsrooms. Candidates have fought ferociously to attract the estimated 32 million Latino voters eligible to vote this election. Bernie Sanders captured just over half of the Latino vote last weekend in Nevada and cruised to an easy victory in the state. To better understand the issues most important to them, we checked in on a candidate forum for Latino voters and with a first-time voter agonizing over her decision. KERA's Stella Chavez leads off our report from Houston.
Mariachis greet visitors arriving at San Jacinto College outside Houston for a Democratic candidate forum. Latino teens and young adults stream inside. They're energized and ready to vote.
I'm Ranulfo Alvarado. I'm 19 and I'm from Splendora, Texas. I'm in Stephen F. Austin State University currently and I'm a junior.
That education hasn't been cheap. He says the candidate with a viable plan to make college more affordable could get his vote.
A lot of people who go into college, they get into massive debt and then they have to pay it off. So it'd be nice if the government can actually fund higher education.
My name's Junwen Sigler. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Texas at Austin in the design program.
Like a number of people here, Sigler favors Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, in part because he leans strongly to the left.
There's all sorts of talks about working across the aisle and being more centrist and in the middle, but people don't want the middle anymore, you know? We've seen what the middle does, and we want change.
Among the changes these young Latino voters want to see, policies that address climate change and affordable health care. The data show these voters could transform Texas. This year, Latinos will make up the largest racial and ethnic minority group eligible to vote in the presidential election. The crowd chants. A voter registration table sits in the foyer, ready to sign up new voters. 21-year-old Giselle Torres is a student at the University of North Texas. She says it's time for new leaders.
The representation that we have, or the lack of, in this community, in Texas specifically, because we're such a big amount of people here. It's mostly Latino, Latina, Hispanic. I think that we're not very well represented.
Beyond Texas, only California has more eligible Latino voters. Now, California's moved up its primary to Super Tuesday this year. The state wants more of a say in who's nominated for president. I'm Stella Chavez in Houston. Now from San Diego, KPBS's Max Rivlin-Nadler tells us that obstacles to voting still remain.
Early voting in California has been going on for almost a month now. At San Diego's Scripps Ranch High School, it's on a lot of students' minds.
I'm Marlene Herrera. I'm 17 years old, and I'll be voting this year for the general election.
Marlene's a senior and tells me Latinx voters are often in a bind. They might lean conservative, but have an aversion to Republicans with hardline immigration policies. Marlene says in the 2016 presidential election,
my family members, they kind of, once it came down to the two candidates, they kind of were like, well, now we don't want to vote.
For Democrats, winning in November could hinge on picking a candidate Latinos are motivated to get out and vote for. One big hurdle, California's closed primary system. Unlike in Texas, only registered Democrats can vote in party primaries. Voters like Marlene, who leans Democratic, often identify as independents. When she registered to vote last year, she decided not to join a political party.
As I'm learning more, I don't think I will be. I'll just see which candidate would suit me better rather than the party.
Young Latinos in the state are driving up the amount of registered voters. At the same time, the number of registered California Democrats and Republicans continues to fall. Voters with no party preference, like Marlene, are on the rise. In San Diego County, they're 28% of voters. Just 38% are registered Democrats. Another obstacle for Democrats looking to win big with the youth vote? Age. In Texas and California, 17-year-olds like Marlene can't vote in the primary, even though they'll be 18 by the general election.
This is just, you're stuck. It's like the young vote just doesn't really get a say.
In another Super Tuesday state, Colorado, 17-year-olds are voting in primaries for the first time. Come November, Marlene knows she won't be voting for Donald Trump. Her grandparents are from Mexico, and many of her friends are DACA recipients or undocumented. That's going to be a lingering problem for Republicans trying to connect with this growing independent voting bloc in Texas, California, and beyond. In California, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler for KPBS.
That was Stella Chavez and Max Rivlin-Nadler. Their reporting is part of Every 30 Seconds, an initiative from PRI's The World that tracks young Latino voters through the November election. You can find more of the series at PRI.org. Now we turn to look at how the Democratic presidential candidates are approaching Super Tuesday and the rest of the primary season. To help break down the remainder of the race is Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College in Southern California. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Set the table for Super Tuesday as we move from a part of the election that's gone state by state to this really what is in a sense a national election with 14 states representing about 40% of the American population. What changes for the candidates?
You go from retail to wholesale politics. Pete Buttigieg did really well in Iowa basically by moving there. He spent lots of time in people's living rooms, meeting people one by one, having conversations. You can't do that on Super Tuesday. Millions of people live in these states, and you have to have both an effective ground operation and a strong media presence. And a lot of candidates just aren't able to do that.
Is television all important when it comes to Super Tuesday because the candidates can't be in this many places at one time?
Television is an important part of the mix, but now that we're in 2020, social media is also an important part of the mix. You're going to see the candidates on Facebook, other social media sites. It's very hard to avoid Michael Bloomberg, even if you want to. So that is something that really has changed, but you are also going to see television ads. And one of the reasons Bloomberg is still a factor is that he's been advertising in these states, especially California, for a long time.
Because so many states are in play, do the candidates essentially have to just pick some to spend most of their time in?
It depends on the candidate. Bloomberg has the unprecedented luxury of being able to play hard everywhere because he has essentially unlimited resources. He is by far the richest person who's ever run for president of the United States. By way of comparison, his net worth is about 25 times that of Nelson Rockefeller, adjusted for inflation.
What happens at the end of the day if we come out of all of these primaries and caucuses and there's not a single candidate that has more than 50% support and we go to a convention that's brokered?
Nobody knows because it hasn't really happened since 1952. The 1976 Republican convention, Reagan and Ford were close in the count, but it was decided on the first ballot, albeit by a modest margin for Ford. No presidential nomination has gone to more than one ballot since Adlai Stevenson in 1952.
As a political scientist, I mean, do you savor the idea of a contested convention and the excitement of the drama?
Political scientists and political junkies have lived all of our lives for this scenario. We've been waiting for this. Yes, a
finally,
contested convention. Yes, and a lot of us are fans of the old movie, The Best Man, with Henry Fonda and Cliff Robertson. And I have to tell my students when I show clips from that, well, it really doesn't work that way anymore. But now it might, which is really cool.
To the many people who are too young to remember a negotiated convention, how would that play out?
The delegates themselves would matter. In recent decades, the delegates have basically been agents for their candidates. And being a delegate is like having an all-access pass to a really cool rally. But it's not really being a major decision maker. But if the nomination goes to more than one ballot, the delegates could count. Candidates will start getting in touch with the delegates trying to persuade them, much as they did in the movie The Best Man. And the superdelegates will come into play. Under new rules instituted at the insistence of Bernie Sanders, the superdelegates can't vote on the first ballot, but they can in subsequent ballots, and it'd be fascinating to see where they come out.
And these are really the party honchos, right? I mean, the powers that be within the party.
That's right. They won't exactly be brokers. It's not going to be like days when governors could deliver large chunks of delegates. But they will have influence. And how that works out, nobody really knows.
Stepping back from the convention, we've heard so much about one word this election cycle, electability, and people's concerns about electability and electability versus being genuinely passionate for a candidate. Well, first off, what is your read on that conversation? I mean, obviously, it's come up in past elections, but do you think that issue is particularly intense this election cycle?
Yes, it's intense because for many Democrats, the number one priority is beating Donald Trump. They want a candidate who can beat Trump. The question is, which candidate is best positioned to beat Trump? And there are several diverse theories of the case. There's one theory that you need somebody like Buttigieg or Klobuchar, somebody who has a reputation for being more moderate or practical. Perhaps Joe Biden, who has name ID, has a great well of affection among many Americans. The other theory of the case is that you need somebody who can inspire passion, who can gin up turnout, and that would be the case for Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders.
And one thing that unites everybody in the Democratic Party right now, from Bloomberg to Sanders to everyone in between, is a contempt of President Trump. Is that enough to win?
The hatred for Trump is going to get any Democrat to 47%. The Democrats could nominate a rancid ham sandwich and get 47% of the vote because their supporters hate Trump that much. But you don't win with 47%. You got to go over 50% of the two-party vote. That's where you need a compelling message. That's where you need to convince those very few remaining undecided voters that you're on their side, that you'll be an effective president. And that's the question Democrats will be thinking about as they choose their candidate.
Professor Jack Pitney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Countdown to Super Tuesday.
Most of the focus has been on the Democratic Party primaries, since the GOP, of course, already has President Trump running for re-election. But that doesn't mean Republicans are idly standing by as they await their opponent. To check in on GOP strategy this primary season, we are joined by James Dickey, chairman of the Republican Party of Texas. James, thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
The race for the Democratic presidential nomination is getting a lot of attention at the moment, especially in these final days before Super Tuesday. From the perspective of an incumbent like President Trump, what's the best way to use this time?
Well, in talking to the president's team. One of the questions I've heard is, does a team have a preference of who they might oppose in the general election race? And the consistent answer over the past year has been that it really doesn't matter from their perspective, that he is running on a campaign of promises made, promises kept, and that more than in recent memory, he can point to multiple things he did that were exactly what he told the voters he was going to do when he was running. He's got a track record of success. And conversely, on the Democrat side, the policies that they are advocating are so extreme, and there's really no distinction on that side either.
So you mentioned earlier that the president and his supporters feel pretty equally confident no matter who the Democratic nominee is. Do you think the strategy will need to be different depending on who the nominee is?
Well, I think clearly, Bernie has been most obvious in being willing to own and wear the label of socialist and communist. But every other candidate...
Excuse me for interrupting. I don't think he's called himself a communist.
Okay, yeah.
He has not called himself a communist.
No, but he said he thought the Soviet Union was a great place, was run well and was a great place. And the same with... So he has praised communist organizations. Yeah. So I think he'd be less resistant to the label, but the policies that are being advanced by all of the other Democrat candidates are no less socialist policies. So there might be a nominal difference in the technique, but that would be it.
So what are you watching for on Super Tuesday?
What we'd like to see in Texas is a really strong show of turnout. What we know is that the Democrats have been trying to make the case that they could flip Texas any minute now. Now, their claims to that are no less are no greater now than they were in 2014, and we went on to win dramatically in 2014. So I think it's just them continuing until hopefully their prediction someday becomes true. But we're doing the work to make sure that not only does that prediction not come true in the foreseeable future, but that we continually have proof points against that.
As party chair, how do you know when your state is a battleground state?
Well, I'm old enough to remember when Texas was a Democrat state and California was a Republican state. And so I have consistently had the mantra for everyone that, you know, nothing lasts forever and you have to earn your position with the voters. And that has to be completely lived out by the elected officials and by the parties every single year. It wasn't that long ago. It was only 17 years ago when, for the very first time since Reconstruction, Republicans ever took over the Texas House. But my message to everyone every single election is you need to run like you're down 10 points, and you need to make sure you clearly communicate to the voters that you know and you want to earn their votes. And external factors like who's getting press coverage about whether or not a state is going to flip is irrelevant. You need to run that way every single election, every time.
James Dickey, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
When we return, digital may be the future, but is it a secure way to vote?
Digital voting is a very scary thing for most people, especially every computer scientist I've ever talked to. The problem is your vote can be gotten at.
That's when the countdown to Super Tuesday continues.
And each candidate has its own stance. At the end of the day, we should all support who we all like have to vote for, because it's only one person versus one other person.
I'm wanting to vote for someone who I think will beat Trump, and I think Pete Buttigieg is the best candidate that we have for that right now. I mean, I feel like Sanders and Warren are pretty divisive, and I feel like it's going to be harder for them to pull a moderate vote.
Well, we think all the current candidates or anyone who can beat Trump is someone we're going to vote for. It's going to be pretty much that simple.
That was Eric Torres Gonzalez of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Mariah Hamaker of Provo, Utah, and Jay Miller of Fort Worth, Texas, all states that vote on Tuesday. I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think from KERA in Dallas.
And I'm Saul Gonzalez, co-host of the California Report from KQED in San Francisco. This is the Countdown to Super Tuesday, a co-production of Public Radio's Texas and California newsrooms. Now, the actual mechanics of how our votes are counted and reported has come into question this primary season. Things got off to a pretty rocky start in Iowa when results were delayed and then found to contain errors. That led to the resignation of the state's Democratic Party chair. And now some voters in Los Angeles County are concerned about new touchscreen voting machines that were approved by the state only a few weeks ago. I visited with some concerned Angelenos last Saturday who were out to vote early. One of them was Chris R., who was worried his vote wasn't counted.
According to the computer, the ballot was cast. However, basically when I finished making all my selections, the paper came back out and my vote was printed on top of like the sort of diagnostic report from the ballot box.
Oh.
So
you got technical information.
Exactly. So it's like it's overlaid on top of like, oh, you voted for, you know, XYZ, you know, people. So according to the computer, it said that everything went through, but I'm a bit skeptical.
You want to make sure that your paper receipt
exactly.
is indeed your paper receipt.
Exactly.
To answer some of these voting questions, we're joined now by Lana Rae Atkison, director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy at the University of New Mexico, and an advisory board member for the MIT Election Lab. Lana Rae, welcome.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
How did Super Tuesday become a thing in the first place?
Well, you know, we have a long process to this crazy nomination, but originally it was because Southern states wanted to have a distinctive voice. And so this goes back to 1988 and thinking about Al Gore as a candidate. So it started out as a strategy for Southern states to move the Democratic Party and candidates more towards a moderate position.
Of course, this year on Super Tuesday, we also have Massachusetts and Maine and Minnesota and California. Did the strategy to give Southern states more of a say actually work that way?
No, not really. It didn't really have an effect. And so a lot of Southern states moved out of it and have done their own thing. You know, states move in and out of the process in terms of where they put themselves over time. Sometimes states go early, sometimes states go late. Sometimes they have a favorite son, and so they want to move their primary date up. So it varies a lot.
From the perspective of any state looking for influence on presidential candidates' agendas, what are the pros and cons of being part of this large voting bloc on Super Tuesday as opposed to holding primaries before or after?
You know, this is the first state that the party allows a lot of states to enter the process. That's why we have this sort of, you know, Super Tuesday or what I like to call Tsunami Tuesday, because there's so many delegates at stake. The first four, of course, you're getting a lot more attention in terms of, you know, those one-to-one conversations with candidates that can happen in Iowa and New Jersey and, you know, maybe Nevada and South Carolina. So here you're really creating momentum. And then Super Tuesday usually ends up being a test of those candidates that have come out of the first four. Obviously, that's more complicated this time with Michael Bloomberg and all the investment he's put into that.
How much variation is there among different states as to how primary elections are carried out? And why does that variation exist?
Well, you have two kinds of things. You have state-run primaries, which is our normal way that we run elections for any primary contest or any general election contest. And then you have party-run primaries, and you have caucuses, which are also run by the parties. And then you have two different parties, and the parties have different rules. So, you know, we don't really have a competitive Republican contest, but one really important difference between Republicans and Democrats is that some states for Republicans go all with the winner, and we don't do that at all for Democrats. They have a proportional rule. And so that generally means that if you have, you know, two races going on at once, that Republicans pick their winner sooner. It also means in the case where we don't have superdelegates, that we could end up in this election with what we would call a brokered convention, where there was no candidate on the first ballot at the convention who got enough votes to win the nomination.
How much do early primary results from states like Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, how much do they affect the choices made on Super Tuesday?
You know, we believe that they matter a lot, and that's why we have preserved, in essence, this crazy process. You know, the idea is that those early states help to winnow the field and clarify which candidates everyone else should be focused on. You know, what we're seeing with Michael Bloomberg in Super Tuesday with the $62 billion backing of his own money, he's able to generate a lot of buzz on ads. And the idea is that's not the way we want to have a nomination campaign, or at least that's the way the parties have thought of it previously, that we want that opportunity for retail politics and the momentum that comes from winning to be an important factor in the nomination campaign.
How much do the results on Super Tuesday typically narrow the field of presidential candidates in a contested primary?
Usually quite a bit. I mean, historically, if we go back even to 2008, when there were sort of a lot of Democrats in the race, you know, by Super Tuesday, it really had winnowed down to Obama and Clinton at that point. So, you know, we're in a different state right now.
An NPR, a PBS Marist poll last month found that 41% of Americans do not think the U.S. is prepared to protect the election system from attempted foreign interference in 2020. How concerned should we be about the security of first primary elections and then the general election?
Well, I think as long as states are running elections, that we are under good hands. Our election system is really quite good. We have a very decentralized election system that bodes well for keeping things safe and secure. Where you get concerned is more these caucuses and state-run primaries. The problem is parties don't run elections. They win elections. And so they really don't have the experience to run a high-quality election. You know, it's all volunteers, very little training, no experience. They've changed all the rules. So these races, it's definitely, you know, very complicated, which is why we saw Nevada take, you know, a couple of days to come in. And the process isn't as easily clear. It hasn't always been there. And frankly, parties should get out of the business of running elections.
Many people have been doing confidential transactions online for some time now, right? They're sharing medical information with health providers. They're doing banking and investment transactions. What sort of progress has been made toward widely available options for digital voting?
Well, digital voting is a very scary thing for most people, especially every computer scientist I've ever talked to. The problem is your vote can be gotten at because it would be a much more open system than your bank, right? I mean, that's a relationship between you and your bank. I mean, imagine the state government setting up a similar relationship with every voter. So it's a much more complicated process to think about digitized voting. It's not something that we're moving to because, you know, we believe that the risks are still too high. But technology is changing, and there might be a future Tate when, you know, we can sit at home and get a chance to vote.
Historically, incumbent presidents have an advantage in reelection campaigns. How much of that is because it is usually only the challenging party candidates who face a really intensive primary contest?
Some, but not very much. People who are going to vote Democratic are going to vote Democratic in the general election, regardless of what happens in the primary campaign. On the other hand, you know, different candidates incur different costs. Certainly, you've seen in the past few days a real vetting process just start for Senator Sanders. You know, part of the reason we have this long nomination campaign and all these events early on is to have a national vetting process of the candidate to clarify who they are and what they've done so that you don't get to the general election stage and suddenly find out all kinds of new things that you didn't before know.
Lana Rae Atkison is director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy at the University of New Mexico. Lana, thank you so much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. Great conversation.
You're listening to the Countdown to Super Tuesday.
Okay, so far this hour, we've talked about how Democratic Party voters can't seem to unite around one candidate and about how problematic our voting procedures are. There's been lots of math. Elections can be positively draining.
So to wrap up this hour, we're going to talk with someone who spends her time making light of what can be very heady times. Nagin Farsad is host of the Fake the Nation podcast, which is pitched as comedy about politics without any of the politics about politics. We reached her at the co-working space where she writes in New York. Nagin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You have a regular podcast to produce. You have stand-up shows to perform. Do you feel like there's a benefit to never running out of material?
I wish that was the case. Like, I wish I could derive any jokes from this. It mostly just feels miserable. I think part of it is the same thing that happened with Trump is that everyone thought he was going to be a treasure trove for comedy. But at a certain point, he's just, offering up the same kind of crazy tweets day in and day out. So the comedy just kind of gets too worn and too old. So it you know, becomes hack at a certain point. And I kind of feel like we're reaching that point with these elections.
There are a number of intriguing sort of storylines to this election. It features our first openly gay candidate. We also have a self-described democratic socialist who is leading the field, has clearly moved the party further to the left. He's hoping to take on the first ever impeached president to run for re-election. How do you make sense of all this?
It's funny because we had like people like Klobuchar saying on the debate stage, you know, something about an uncle in the deer stand. I mean, there's just so much weird, like little things that are uttered throughout this election process. It's interesting that the one thing about Pete Buttigieg that's the most revolutionary about him is that, you know, he's an openly gay candidate is almost totally an afterthought for Democrats. So there's just so much about this, these elections that are quite revolutionary and yet no one's really talking about them. The fact that the front runner wasn't even really a Democrat, that he calls himself a socialist Democrat. There's just kind of an endless trove of these things. I think we've become so accustomed to being slapped in the face with like new and crazier political phenomenon that we're just desensitized to it now. You know, it's just like, oh yeah, a gay man and a democratic socialist running for president, no big deal. Like, and that's kind of how we're taking it.
On your podcast, you sometimes will talk about how politics intersects with race in this country. Early on, the Democrats were talking a lot about putting forth a diverse field of candidates to speak to a diverse party and population in this country. That is not who's left. What happened?
I don't know. I mean, when I watched the debate stage on Tuesday night, my heart just sank. Like every time the camera opens onto the seven remaining candidates and they're just all white, it feels, I'm an Iranian American Muslim, like all of your listeners, I'm sure. It's just disappointing that we got to this point. We had some really excellent candidates like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. I'm truly shocked that they weren't able to rise through. And so I almost think it's because voters are just, they're so concerned with having someone run against Trump and Trump ran so effectively on an anti-immigrant, kind of generally like anti-people of color platform that I think even subconsciously Democrats are like, well, the person we get into office, our nominee should just be a white person if they're going to run against Trump. And I think some of that is even working subconsciously on Democrats who are otherwise completely comfortable with a candidate of color.
Regardless of who wins the Democratic nomination and who wins the general election in November, Nagin, a lot of the issues that this president, next president will have to deal with are not that funny, right? We have coronavirus and economic inequality and global tensions and a lot of other things. What do you think is the value in being able to laugh about something as important as an election?
You know, the goal for me, you know, and with a show like Fake the Nation is to, you know, have listeners who have been kind of really in the drugs of the doldrums of this election cycle to come out of it feeling a little bit out of the each episode feeling a little bit energized. And I think at least the laughs and the talking about it and kind of getting it out of our systems, it's cathartic. And I think it will help. And from my little tiny, tiny corner of the universe, hopefully help my listeners, you know, jump into action, because we can't just vote. We have to vote enthusiastically and extremely large numbers. And we have to be knocking on doors, and we have to be sending poster cards, and we have to be making phone calls, and we have to be doing it with some measure of glee, or else we're not going to be able to sustain ourselves.
Nagin Farsad is host of the Fake the Nation podcast. Nagin, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's going to do it for us. Thank you for listening to the Countdown to Super Tuesday, a joint production of KQED in San Francisco, KERA in Dallas, and the Public Radio Texas and California newsrooms. I'm Saul Gonzalez, co-host of the California Report.
And I'm Chris Boyd, host of Think. Thanks for listening.